Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict mourns the loss of two great church leaders, a Catholic cardinal and an Orthodox patriarch. Australia launches new efforts to curb alcoholism and abuse amongst Aboriginal communities, but is the crackdown doomed to failure? And a look back at an initiative at one of Rome's pontifical universities aimed at easing tensions between the West and the Muslim world. Welcome to the programme. Pope Benedict on Monday recalled a great leader of the Church in France, Cardinal Jean-Marie Lustiger, who died in Paris at the weekend, aged 80. Born to Polish-Jewish parents, he converted to the Catholic Church in 1940 and was ordained priest in 1954. Cardinal Lustiger served as Archbishop of Paris for nearly a quarter of a century, from 1981 to 2005, and throughout his ministry worked tirelessly for improved relations between Christians and Jews. In a telegram sent to the current Archbishop of Paris, André 23, Pope Benedict recalled the Cardinal's dedicated and discerning service to the Church in Paris, and before that in the Diocese of Orléans. Meanwhile, at his Sunday Angelus address, Pope Benedict recalled another great church figure, the Orthodox Patriarch Teoctist of Romania, who was buried in Bucharest on Friday. The Pope spoke of the Patriarch's dedication to the cause of Christian unity and the warm welcome he gave to Pope John Paul II during his visit to Romania in 1999. My colleague Charles Collins takes a closer look at the Pope's words to pilgrims and visitors gathered at the papal summer residence of Castel Gandolfo on Sunday.
2 days after Patriarch Teoctist of the Romanian Orthodox Church was laid to rest in the cathedral in Bucharest, Pope Benedict XVI asked the Lord to grant him eternal rest. Quoting the Orthodox funeral liturgy, the Holy Father said, "May his memory be eternal."
Questa nobile figura di pastore che ha amato la sua Chiesa e ha dato un positivo contributo alle relazioni tra cattolici ed ortodossi.
The Pope spoke about the contribution the Patriarch made to Catholic-Orthodox relations and spoke of the constant encouragement he gave the International Mixed Commission on Catholic-Orthodox Theological Dialogue. He said a clear testament of his ecumenical commitment were the two visits he made to Pope John Paul II and the welcome which he, in turn, gave the Bishop of Rome during his historic pilgrimage to Romania in 1999. The Pope was speaking during his Angelus address in Castel Gandolfo. He also remembered that it was in Castel Gandolfo 29 years ago that Pope Paul VI died on the Feast of the Transfiguration. He said the memory of Paul VI urges us to lift our eyes on high. The Holy Father also remarked on the Sunday Gospel, underlining Christ's warning to guard against all greed, for though one may be rich, everything passes, everything can end suddenly, and that although wealth in itself is an accumulation of goods, it must not be considered as the absolute good.
Today's gospel reminds us that all the treasures we have come from the goodness of God. May your time here at Castel Gandolfo in Rome deepen your understanding of our faith and renew in you the desire to share your gifts and goods with others.
The Pope said that the real treasure for which Christians must tirelessly seek lie in the things from above, there where Christ can be found at the right hand of the Father.
Thanks there to Charles Collins for that report on Pope Benedict's Angelus address. The plight of Australia's Aborigines is under the spotlight again after a recent report found widespread sexual abuse of children amongst Aboriginal communities is being fuelled by heavy drinking. After the report was released, Australian Prime Minister John Howard declared Aboriginal child sex abuse a national emergency, and the government has since announced new restrictive measures to crack down on alcohol sales in the Northern Territory. Under the scheme, Aborigines would be tracked and their alcohol purchases recorded, measures which critics say are discriminatory and do nothing to tackle the problems at the root of such abuses. Australia's Aborigines or Indigenous people make up 2% of the national population. Most Indigenous people live in remote communities or towns and have battled poverty, unemployment and discrimination for decades. My colleague Susie Hodges has been finding out more about the plight of the Aboriginal people and how the Catholic Church is trying to help.
In the good old days, Australia's Aborigines lived by hunting kangaroos and working as cattlemen. But nowadays, all too often, they're drinking themselves to death. In Australia's Northern Territory, alcohol causes an Aborigines' death every 38 hours. A recent report found what it called a river of grog, or alcohol, was destroying Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory and fueling abuse of women and children. In the area around Alice Springs in the Northern Territory, many Indigenous people live in third world conditions, with as many as 20 people sharing one room. One person who helps minister to Aboriginals in the Alice Springs area is Catholic chaplain Father Asali Ras, himself an Indigenous. He says the government's big stick approach is not the right way to solve the problems afflicting the Aboriginal communities, and more consultation with elders is needed to come up with a long-term plan to improve their lives.
Well, right now it's pretty pathetic, actually. The Indigenous are not feeling good about the whole aggressive approach by the government. There's been a lot of questions on the details of the federal government's proposal. And so right now in Central Australia, things are not looking good.
What are some of the reasons why there is such a problem, though, of alcohol abuse, drug abuse among the Indigenous people?
The situation exists due to a combination of factors. Firstly, this is the ongoing impact of colonization. Personally, I feel it's a fail of governments to actively involve Aboriginal elders. People tend to ignore the cultural worldview of Indigenous people. And there is also the lack of recognition of their own diversity here and lack of support for the community-based Aboriginal organizations that are going on in town. There's also, of course, the poverty, inadequate housing and the health services in Alice Springs.
So do people like you, the Indigenous people, feel abandoned and forgotten, even despised by the whites?
Well, there's a mixed feelings out there, especially amongst the Indigenous people. There are real concerns from the Indigenous. First of all, it's just that the ongoing negativity that has been portrayed in the media, it's always been against them. And so they feel that, well, the mainstream community know better than us. So they tend to withdraw and not get involved in trying to face the problems. It's kind of a blame game going on here, you know.
And when it comes to the rest of Australians, the mainstream community, how do they view the Aborigines? How do you feel that they view them?
There's an element of racism here as well, and I've faced it personally as a chaplain. There's a sense of national disgrace, to be honest, of what is going on. The majority of Australians, I would say, don't have any idea at all of what's going on in regional communities. So people tend to keep a distance from the realities.
You go out and minister to the Aboriginal communities in Central Australia, particularly in and around Alice Springs. I mean, when you talk to them, do they come out with any anecdotes that somehow sum up the extent of their plight or their anger, their frustration?
Yeah. See, one of the biggest worries is really how they're going to be consulted so that they too can, you know, identify solutions to ensure that, you know, whatever outcomes are sustainable in the long run. See, one of the things that really makes people sick here is the ongoing poverty that I see in people's homes. People, especially children, they're sick because they're poor. And the poor health conditions that I find in remote communities, which in many ways brings down to the inequality between the mainstream and the indigenous peoples.
Can you perhaps give me some concrete examples of what living conditions are like amongst some of the Aboriginal communities you visit?
Okay. I just came back visiting one of the camps. There's no electricity. Now, this is 21st century Australia. There are camps here that don't have electricity. Homes, tin shed, okay? Just tin shed. And right now is winter. It's minus one in Alice Springs. They've got fires in their homes, you know, going. You know, there's no heaters.
What about water? Do they have running water? What are the sanitary conditions like?
There is running water, but sanitary conditions are not good. Some camps are not connected to the main plumbing system in the main town. Some don't have street lights, and so there's ongoing social problems. You know, the overcrowdedness in people's homes.
When you say overcrowded, yeah. How many people, say, for instance, are sleeping in one room?
Okay, in one room, there'll be around more than 10. Sometimes I've counted about around 20 people in one room.
Does the government or authorities have any long-term plans to improve their living conditions?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I mean the government is really trying hard. Huh? Personally, there is a big gap here. You know, it's the cultural differences. To leave Ellistown and just to drive 5 minutes away, it seems that you're going into another century. Now, the government is trying hard to put in the necessary infrastructure. At the same time, you have the indigenous, you know, holding strong to their culture and traditions. The government is trying hard, I know, but it seems some of the programs are really not working.
Do you know why not?
I personally think the answers are within themselves. A few weeks ago, our local bishop released a media release responding to the inquiry into the protection of Aboriginal children from sexual abuse, and he said that government approach is really, it's sort of a big brother approach, you know, a bit bullying. However, he said that any approach ought to be in partnership with indigenous people. Without the involvement, without the voice of the indigenous, it can easily happen. Aboriginal people, many of whom, like today, they already feel powerless. They will just end up feeling disempowered.
You're a Catholic indigenous person. How many of the indigenous people are Catholic?
There are 6,000 registered Catholics here. I would say that about half in Alice Springs, in Central Australia. So it's close to about 3,000 who are Catholics.
And what is the Catholic Church doing to help them?
We've got a lot of activities, ongoing activities, you know, that service the camps and the communities. We've got a centre care that is, you know, part of the welfare arm of the church in Australia, including here in our diocese, supporting the Aboriginal organisations in terms of personnel and just being there with them and walking with them during these difficult times. And schools, you know, we've got schools that are going on, and our health services here. There's a lot of activities, church-run programs that help to support the indigenous.
When it comes to some of these problems we mentioned earlier, like alcohol abuse, drug abuse, petrol sniffing even, when you talk to people who may be struggling with these kind of problems, do they tell you what drove them to it?
Look, when I go to the camps, this is what they tell me. There's nothing to do. There's high percentage of unemployment out here. So when people have nothing to do and they're receiving the welfare money, people call it here the sit-down money, oh, they just tend to drink. I mean, what else is there? They cannot get into the mainstream work because it's just too high of expectations on the mainstream society. So the level of anxiety increases, which also leads to one of the big problems we're facing here is the suicide. I've never buried so many suicide-related deaths in Central Australia since I arrived here as a priest.
So, I mean, if you could sum up, how do the Aboriginals feel about their future? How would you describe their overall mood?
At this moment in time, there is mixed feelings. Right now, from what I'm feeling, from what I'm hearing from the Indigenous, they're looking for leadership. They're looking for people to really care for them. I know they're still living on hope. You know, when the Pope John Paul came here 20 years ago, that was a really great speech, really asking them to contribute to the, you know, local church and to the economy, and also hopefully that their contribution will be accepted by the mainstream society.
Thanks to Susie Hodges speaking there with Father Asseli Rice. And finally, promoting peace and dialogue with the Muslim world was the aim of a two-week course that took place recently in Rome and Turin, helping Muslim diplomats to better understand the work of the Holy See and local Catholic organizations. The coordinators of the initiative included the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome, the Jacques Maritain International Institute, the Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and St. Joseph's University in Beirut. Diplomats, mainly from North Africa and the Middle East, heard from top Vatican officials, as well as from the heads of Catholic institutes and organizations dealing with delicate issues of international politics and diplomacy.
I think it is very important that the Catholic Church presents its real identity and its functions in the multilateral diplomacy, as well as in various activities that connect the Church and the Holy See to society.
As the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva, Archbishop Silvano Tomasi was one of the speakers, discussing the key role diplomacy can play in easing tensions between the West and the Muslim world.
We have in the West and in the Americas, a difference between religion and society. There is a separation normally between church and state, while in the Islamic tradition, there is one community that combines religious identity and political activity. So this is needed, this kind of distinction, to avoid confusion in the perception of Islamic countries, because they associate everything coming from the West with also Christianity, while many issues, there is almost an antagonistic situation between what some Western countries portend to do vis-a-vis Muslim countries, or the values that they want to export, and the position of the Holy See. So for all these reasons, I think this experiment of bringing together diplomats from Arab and Muslim countries of the North Africa and the Middle East is a very bright idea. It's this type of concrete dialogue that opens up possibilities of negotiating issues that are difficult and complex in today's world.
This would somehow replace the work of the purely interreligious dialogue. In other words, it's more important perhaps to keep this pluridimensional approach to interreligious dialogue than just a specifically religious approach.
Yes, I think dialogue is articulated in different ways today. I think we have learned a lot in the last 40 years since the Council and the Decree on Religious Freedom. There is a dialogue of life where you have Muslim families and Christian families that interact. They talk, they even discuss their religious identities together in a very informal, very grassroots type of way. And this happens in a lot of areas around Europe with the new immigrant communities. In Africa, I remember Ethiopia, where you have even intermarriage, where one partner is Christian, the other remain Muslim, and they function, and there are no problems. Then you have a second level almost of dialogue, where you have religious specialists who talk about their theological differences or their insights, the roots of the connections, the linkages between religions. And this is kind of academic and sincere and important, but it is rarely filters down to the people who are the ones who eventually make the decisions on important issues affecting relationship between states and between communities. And then I think there is a third level, and that is the official political level, where you have in the multilateral system that is developing very fast in today's world, where you have a lot of intergovernmental bodies combining forces, presences from Muslim, Hindu, Confucians, Christians of all denominations. And at this level, you don't enter into a specific discussion of religion, but you confront decisions that affect the lives of people, and these decisions are based on values that come from different cultural and religious traditions that need to be taken into account in order to organize a system of interventions in the international reality that makes some sense for everybody. So this initiative here at the Gregorian University and the Jacques Maritain Institute moves at this third level of dialogue. It's more limited in a way, but more in-depth. So it forces future diplomats to say, well, this is the reality of the Holy See and in the international scene, and it makes a contribution that is acceptable, not only, but it is constructive, and on which we can converge.
We heard Pope Benedict again in Brazil talking about how the Church must stay out of politics if it wishes to continue being an independent observer, an independent entity. And yet you're talking about the interface between politics and religion that in a way cannot be separated. How do you interpret his words on this?
I don't see a contradiction with what the Holy Father is saying, which is right, especially in reference to party politics and to specific ideological convictions that transform political action into de facto political partisan politics. Instead, what I'm talking about in reference to the presence of the Holy See in intergovernmental bodies is a dialogue that deals with the concrete issues, the big problems of peace, of solidarity, of development, human rights, and you go down the line, no? That need to be addressed in a collective way by the international community. Otherwise, we will not find an answer. So this kind of approach is not political in the traditional sense of small politics and the national level, parties and power. It's more on the level of forming an international new culture or way of thinking that converge on supporting basic values. The dignity of the human person, the priority of peace over force, the need of having some form of solidarity with the smaller countries to allow the small economies to enter into the open market and not to have just a few big countries to call the shots and determine what is good or bad, usually for their own interest. So this is the way that the Holy See is present and finds a support and an adherence on the part of other countries and other forces, because there is a lot of goodwill out there on which we need to bank and to use it as leverage to open up possibilities for the construction of a future international society where globalization is not at the service of a few people, but it becomes a mechanism that allows everybody to participate around the table of life.
There is, as you say, an increasing presence of this religious voice, if you like, informing this new culture that you're talking about. And yet you spoke recently about an anti-religious fanaticism that is becoming a new threat, really, to believers, even in the most democratic countries. What exactly do you mean by that?
In my experience in the Human Rights Council, for example, there is an explicit awareness, and ambassadors talk very openly of the importance of having round tables on religious freedom, freedom of expression, and the conviction, the deep convictions of people, even if they are not conviction framed in religious terminology or in religious imagery. Because there is a felt need that in order to function in today's world, in international relations, you need to take into account the factor of the deep convictions of people. And these convictions are directly affecting their political choices and even conditioning possibilities of economic development. So in that way, I think there is a positive step forward in bringing back, in a way, into the public debate a religious dimension. This is something in the making, something that I perceive as a little bit of a novelty in these international fora. On the other hand, we also have an extreme reaction in some areas of the world against people of different belief and different religious convictions. And this reaction goes into violence in on occasions. We have seen examples in various parts of the world, from Turkey to Nigeria to Indonesia and Iraq. What is interesting is that not the governments and not society as such are the actors of these deeds of violence, but are small groups within these societies. They run out of the control of the state, either because the state is too weak or it's unpredictable reactions, but they are the result of a cultural outlook, because these small groups feed on some traditional or fundamentalist interpretations of their beliefs that bring out the worst in the heart of human beings, a sense of revenge, a sense of violence, a sense of extreme defense of an identity that is considered as threatened by people expressing different ideas or proposing, with all freedom and with all respect, an alternative way of thinking. So we have these two phenomena going on side by side, and that's why it's so important to create these kind of links with official people participating in decision-making processes, and above all in the formation of this international future culture, to diffuse the small groups that are fundamentalist in their thinking and allow the common values, as the Holy Father insists, the common reason that we have as human beings, as a tool for the real dialogue before any theological discussion. But on this base of an anthropology, of a understanding of the human being, that allows the commonality to take precedence over our different histories and cultural identities.
And my thanks there to Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.